a handy library called EngelShop, which helps us in the task of basically parsing HTML, but also with some related tasks such as CSS parsing, or even building an interaction model, manipulating websites, and basically serializing them again. I am Florian Rappel. I'm from Regensburg, Germany. I'm a software engineer, writer, and consultant. I'm a Microsoft MVP for C Sharp. Now it's relabeled to .NET. And I'm also a co-project MVP. I give active contributions to various open source projects. And this particular project, EngelShop, is, let's say, my own project, or I'm the main person here. I'm also giving company workshops, talks like this one, and I'm doing general IT consulting. From a technology perspective, I'm mainly using C Sharp, JavaScript, and C++, full stack web developer, and I'm also doing work in high performance computing, so a wide range is covered. The agenda for this talk will be that I start with a general overview of what the DOM actually is and why parsing HTML is so complicated. Then I will quickly introduce some libraries that exist in the .NET framework that we can use, and then come to the EngelShop project. Finally, we will come to the feature-rich interaction model that comes with EngelShop, and I will show a lot of demos. So I will actually rush to the demos because those demos are quite awesome, I think, and they're fun. So let's see how it goes. So what is the document object model? This is a really crappy graphic that is in the background here, but what it really is I can just go to a website, like my own homepage. Then it gets loaded. And finally, I end up with something that gives me a tree-like structure. And basically, the tree-like structure is the representation of this document. So it's a hierarchical view out of this one-dimensional string that's the source. And this particular view comes also with a specified API. And we can use this API in, let's say, JavaScript in the browser to communicate with the browser and manipulate this document object model. And this is highly done nowadays. So the document object model is a hierarchical view of the HTML document. And it also gives us access to this hierarchy in the tree, which are nodes. And those are child nodes. For instance, we now have this one document, and it has two nodes. The document type and the HTML root element. This root element has also child nodes, in this case three things, a head node, then a text node, which is probably just a new line, and then some body element. And if I would go to my homepage in the browser, I can of course do that. Then it gets rendered, okay, that's fine. But I can also access the document object model here. I hope you can all read that. So basically, this is what is called properties. Nice. And I see, for instance, this is one node, the doc type HTML. But I got another one, this HTML node. And this node, of course, has some other properties. Should be already at node level. The children get child nodes. Da-da-da. I don't know why it doesn't work. But let's go to that console view, and I can just query it. So document query selector, for example, of that HTML tag, and I want all child nodes, and here it is, and exactly three things, that head element, then the text node, and body. So same representation. I could, of course, go a little bit more into detail, and I will see the representation that I get in this small app here is exactly the same as in a browser. Of course, one could now argue, yeah, you've probably used something like PhantomJS or some other bridge to some browser, but this is all native C sharp, and it's using this EngelSharp library that I will tell you about. So it's an accurate representation of the undergoing document. So what is the DOM? It is this hierarchical view of an HTML document, and it gives us an API. In order to fully understand the DOM and to represent it correctly, we need to follow the specification. And this is actually where different libraries show a different outcome and different behavior, because they're not all following the specification. The specification is huge. This is the HTML 5.1 nightly, and this is just really the core of HTML, so defines something like parsing and the basic API of some elements. It does not define something like a canvas or what WebGL is or anything like CSS. So this is really just the core, and this may seem like a long document, but in fact it's just a table of contents. So this is huge. The most interesting part for getting the accurate representation is the section 8. So here is the whole process of parsing the document described in very specific details. And also then providing those interfaces that are just used in the browser to query selector and to get those child nodes, and also in this representation I've seen in C sharp. This all follows a specific standard set by the W3C. And the behavior is defined, so what I always experience is same behavior for the same method across different implementations, let's say different browsers, or also in EngelSharp. It's the same behavior. I won't get surprised if I know how a query selector works in the browser. I know already how it works in EngelSharp, because it follows the specification one to one. So there's everything brought to a common denominator. And this is quite interesting, because prior to HTML5, there were a lot of variations. And even one of the most famous JavaScript libraries, jQuery, not only got so famous because it did a lot of things right in the API, but also because it managed to bring all those different browser implementations to one common denominator. So this is one of the crucial points of jQuery. But now with HTML5, everything has gotten better, and of course still browsers differ in some aspects, but the core aspect, this HTML5 part, this is really well specified, and therefore parsing HTML is working exactly the same across different implementations. Otherwise, you're not following the specification, so there's no room for interpretation, so to speak. So how do we do it? There are really common pitfalls in parsing HTML. Let's have a look at this particular page. So this is an error by intention, don't worry. This is the Google error page, and in my opinion, a really nice error page, because it does a lot of things right. It doesn't look so scary at all, which is a good thing for the user. And I can have a look at the source. And maybe one or the other is now a little bit worried. I mean, there's this HTML root element, all right. And most importantly, we got the valid doc type for the HTML5. So this is all fine. But then I heard that tags like meter or title or style, they usually belong in a head tag, but that is missing here. But actually, that's all well defined. I mean, HTML5 defines that these tags will all go to a head tag if not encountered in, let's say, a body tag or somewhere else. So the head tag will be placed here implicitly. All right. And a tag like the anchor element will be placed implicitly in a body. So we have something like an end head tag here and the start of a body tag inserted also for us by the parser automatically. So this is all well defined. And actually modern browsers like Opera here, which is based on Blink, handle this perfectly fine because they're following the standard. However, some libraries may be really, let's say, rudimentary, and they will get into problems. Maybe they will append meter and title and so on into the HTML root element. I don't know. This can be all happen here. But this is all valid HTML. There will be no errors thrown for anything. Also, we see that there's a paragraph, and then there's another paragraph. And what to do with that? Is that one nested in the other? How can one paragraph end up in another? So actually, this second paragraph will implicitly close the first one. So this is also well-defined, and this is also no error. All right. So what we can have is error handling could be made wrong if you do not follow the specification. And some of the other libraries I will tell you about do not have the rich error handling model of HTML5. Therefore, you will end up in the wrong document object model for a website like the Google Error page, for instance, or more complicated ones. Special rules have to be followed. I just mentioned a few. But there's really a huge set of special rules, special tokenization rules, special appending rules, special creation rules. HTML, if seen naively, is really simple to parse. I mean, you probably could end up with regular expressions doing it. Not very good, but to some extent. However, if you look at it in more detail, what HTML5 provides, you will easily see that without the special rules, you will never end up with a document object model that's halfway what the browser can give you. So you need all those special rules, otherwise you're lost. And this is why the specification is that large. It's just edge cases. All right, another thing that needs to be taken care of such a library is encoding, because most of the time we are not interested in, yeah, I got those three lines of HTML as a string, just parse it. But I have a particular page sitting on a particular server, and that will get transferred over the wire, and that will come with a special encoding. And a library should take care of that. So it should follow the algorithms as provided by the W3C, that we can end up with the same text representation as the browser, because the encoding detection and resolution works the same. And actually, encoding is something where you can get a lot of gray hair because it's kind of messy. And EngelSharp also does this, such as the browser does. So what other libraries are there available? Just mention a few. And probably the most famous one is HTML Agility Pack. Has anyone not heard of HTML Agility Pack? Okay, a few. That's good because you do not need to know about it. And is anyone actively using HTML Agility Pack in this room? Okay. Maybe you will change after that. There's a better solution. So if you do not want to pick mine, then you can also go for CS Query. CS Query, so maybe just a few words about HTML Agility Pack. It's probably the most famous one. It's also the most downloaded one, of course. It was the first one, basically, who did it quite right, let's say. So it's not just regular expressions, but it does some parsing. However, not HTML5 compliant parsing, and this is really the crucial point here. So the error detection is more or less like it was formerly in the browsers. Well, this may be an error, so I just do that. But just doing that is not like doing it after the standard. So it might be after the standard by coincidence, but it may also be just a different behavior. And the authors of HTML Agility Pack, they looked at particular browser. Unfortunately, at the time when they created it, all browsers behaved differently for the edge cases. So this is why HTML Agility Pack is also not HTML5 compliant. Either way, it gives you quite nice document object model representation with an API that is not far away from the API given from the W3C. However, the behavior may be completely different, even though the methods have similar names. Okay, and then there's CS Query. This library does a lot of things right. First of all, it uses an HTML5 compliant parser. It's actually a port of a famous HTML5 parser written in Java. But that port in Java should already ring a bell. Nevertheless, the performance is quite okay. Even though this parser has not been taken or maintained actively in the recent years. This means it is HTML5 compliant, but for instance, not HTML5.1 compliant. And in 5.1, there is this template element specified, for instance, and CS Query doesn't know how to handle that, for instance. So there are some cases. However, what it does really right is providing a nice API. it is named CSQuery because it should be something like jQuery for .NET. So it gives you something like a fluent API that is really focused around a query selector. And a query selector is something I will show later, and I already used it in this simple console statement I entered some minutes ago. So query selectors are awesome, and they are certainly in the focus of CSQuery. Even doing some performance optimizations around queries. So this is a quite nice library and certainly something to think about. And then, of course, there's AngleSharp. I won't mention here libraries that just use regular expressions or really primitive parsing, because usually you want to go beyond that. You want to have something as accurate as possible. Okay, and our choice in this talk is, of course, AngleSharp. So this talk is, of course, biased, but bear with that. And we can have a discussion afterwards. All right. So let's look at the ecosystem and how this all grows. First of all, we have an architecture that is, in principle, focused around extensibility. So AngleSharp tries to provide you with a model where you open basically a browsing context, which you can think of as like a tab in your browser. And in this browsing context, you can then navigate to websites, or you can also just place in some HTML snippets. So this is all possible. And you can specify what kind of services this particular browsing context can use. For instance, how it should deliver events, if it should deliver events, or what kind of cookie service you want to use, if you want to use one, or if CSS should be passed, and all things like that. So you can extend it very well, and you can specify what you want very well. So this is all in the architecture. The project itself follows the principle of doing everything by the standard first. So even though the API might look ugly, the naming is a little bit changed, but I come to that in a few seconds. It follows this API, because first implementing this API gives us the ability to put something more sophisticated, nicer to use on top of it in front of extension methods and whatever. If the underlying core is following the specification, we're principle fine. If we just come up with our own API and nothing is really complementary or can be thought as a good aggregation to the existing API that is proposed by the W3C, then you might end up with something that behaves completely different overall. So you want something that is actually as close as possible to the browser, because you know the browser very well, you can debug it very well, and you probably know already the most important methods and fields and so on. All right. Another very important principle is performance. Of course, if I write a really nice parser, I can write that parser really nicely, so such that the code is really nice to read. But then I will probably end up in a language like C# with really bad performance. So I decided that the core, which is the tokenizer and the parser, will be written in very ugly C#, which gives, however, very good performance. Yeah. This is the trade-off I had to make here. Some parts still look really fine, and some people say it's one of the best C# codes. So, well, the other code is either dominating for those guys, or they have a preference for the bad code in the parser itself. And this can be also seen in comparisons. So this is like an old chart, changed a little bit, but the overall outcome is the same. What we have here, you can't read it, but it doesn't matter, are popular websites. So this is tested against really popular sites just to see how it deals with such cases. So we have sites like YouTube, Amazon, and whatever here. And just parsing the HTML, so no CSS parsing or whatever. And looking how the time is. And the lower bar is better. And what is drawn in orange here is CSQuery. That changed a little bit because there are some magic flags you can set to make it miraculously faster. But it's the overall outcome is the same. There are some outliers. I mean, I don't know what site that was, QQ. There's some hard problem there because it always takes a lot of time on this particular site. But that's just CS query. What you can say about AngleSharp is, in most of the cases, it's the fastest one. It's never the slowest one. And their overall time is nearly double as good as HTML Agility Pack. Of course, this is overall those sites. So for a particular site, HTML Agility Pack might even be faster. So there might be some cases like that. I don't know. But usually, these are cases where the parsing time is below 10 milliseconds anyway. So yeah, you have no problem there. The author of CS Query also had some exchange with me, and he told me that the .NET world has definitely longed for a comprehensive functional DOM model. I don't know that, but which is something I never had the energy to do with my own project, which means that I think he made a fairly good point, and this is actually one of the origins of the project. In the future, there will be even more data. I mean, it's all nice to talk about web APIs, but not every site provides one, and sometimes on purpose. So the only way to scrape out data of such pages is to really parse the HTML, and maybe also to log into such a site. So we need some mechanism of submitting forms and loading the page and query selectors through the page and all that stuff. And CS Query can't do that. It's just not as interactive as AngleSharp. I mean, it is really nice to query an existing document object model, and it's also nice to add some new elements. However, those elements are not as special as in AngleSharp. I mean, special from the point of view that anchor elements have more properties than a div element, for instance. So an anchor element also knows about its URL and stuff like that, and a div element just has its plain attribute list. In CS Query, more or less every element is the same, so it does not provide any distinction between the HTML elements. In C-sharp, this is in AngleSharp, this is completely different. So an anchor element will always be mapped to an HTML anchor element, and this is a really special instance then, and provides you with special methods and special properties. All right. One of the points I've mentioned was extensions. So you can easily extend AngleSharp, and actually this is one of the future goals, to provide further libraries. Here we see AngleSharp IO, which would, in theory, it's not realized yet, cover special network services or also special services to the file system. So everything that's IO related. AngleSharp itself is a portable class library, which means that it does not know anything about the platform you're targeting. Therefore, it can't be as sophisticated with a network request, or it can't even access the file system. So you always need to provide something for that. And AngleSharp IO would then basically cover a usual .NET client, and therefore would have access to all the rich APIs and would use them. And something like AngleSharp Media, which would cover media services, maybe audio, video, streaming, or whatever. And a library that already exists is AngleSharp Scripting. We will have a look at that. It's just experimental, but this library will move out of an experimental stage at some point when I have more time to pursue that. AngleSharp also creates a CSS object model, at least when I tell AngleSharp to do that. Otherwise, it will not integrate a CSS parser and only use a CSS parser for things like a query selector, where this particular string that forms this selector has to be passed via a CSS parser. All right, CSS object model would be a talk on its own. So just have a look at the diagram. And this diagram tells me the left box is completely covered by the core library. What we have here is we have some existing source, an HTML code, for instance, and that will go through the HTML parser. And it will practically end up in an iDocument object, which is the underlying representation that's used by the document object model. And here we have a lot of nodes, and some of those nodes have properties, or all of them, and we can have properties that relate to an iStyle sheet. So what is that? That's basically just a CSS style sheet. in order to get that at some magical point, we need to provide some CSS source. Usually there's some interaction going on. And the CSS parser then takes care of that and transforms it. So basically, the I style sheet is the correspondent of the I document in the CSS world. And yeah, this gives us the whole CSS object model, which is then, in this case, embedded in the document object model. We can think of more things that could be done, for instance, providing a renderer. And actually, there is some project on the way, and at some stage, I will also publish that. So EngelShub can also be rendered to real sites. However, rendering is another really complex step, and the specification there is also huge. And also, expecting modern things like Flexbox and so, they will take time to be implemented. And yeah, so this all goes basically beyond static HTML. So we have our rich document object model, which allows us interactivity beyond just sitting around and being queried, but we can interact with it quite nicely. And this results in something like DOM events, for instance. And here's, I think, where I should start the demos, because this is most fun. So let's close this one. Is this font size all right? Or anyone has problems reading it? So I will take a particular snippet. Which one should I take? All right. So this is custom event scripting, which goes a little bit beyond simple DOM events, but they're also included in this part. What I'm doing here is the following. I start by creating a new config with new configuration, and in this case with JavaScript. I will shortly tell you why that, but it's just for illustration. And then I have given this source here. So this is my HTML page. Nothing really fancy here. Most importantly, the correct doc type for HTML5. And then I got some script tag in my body. Okay, whatever. And in my script tag, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm doing something like console log before setting the handler. I'm doing something like console log after setting the handler. And there's something between. Two things. The first one is this, what I call DOM events. So there is a load event. And when that load event is triggered, I want a document loaded to be shown. All right, this is not so fancy, pretty standard. And then I also got some custom events. That's why this particular snippet is called custom event scripting. And this event is called hello. So this is not an event that's provided by the W3C standard, but it's a custom event. I can always create custom events in a document object model. This is then provided by the specification that I can do that. All right, and when I've triggered this element, this particular event, I want to show hello world from JavaScript. So far, so good. But this is just my document, so let's forget about the source right now, and let's concentrate on the code. So what I'm doing here is I'm creating a new browsing context with that given configuration. That configuration is basically the default configuration, and it uses JavaScript. That's everything that's in there. And then I say open async, so I'm opening a new page, and EngelShub is fully about asynchronous calls, so that's why it's quite modern for C#. And here, because I have a fixed snippet, I have to use some kind of lambda syntax. I could otherwise specify a URL or something directly in here, but if I have a stream already or some string, then I need to use this fluent syntax, which is quite nice because I can also specify some things, like, for instance, what the address is of that source. So that address is just the map to it and not really queried from. That's just, I got this snippet, and actually I want to associate it with this address. Anyway, so basically this will just generate me my document. is all I need to know. Then I'm doing a little bit of console write lines just to get some output. For instance, I write the outer HTML. So this is all specified by the W3C of the document element, which is the root element, this HTML, of my document. I just write it to the console. What I will see is basically this thing up here. Basically, I say, because there is no one-to-one transformation between the original source and then the serialized source. So there's no round-tripping possible. Of course, once I serialized it, then round-tripping is possible. But there are more possibilities to end up with the same DOM. So, all right. And now the real fun starts. Because what I'm doing here is I'm actually attaching an event listener to my custom event. Hello, I named it. In C sharp. Ah, okay. Not too special. And then, and this is really ugly, but yeah, there's some more modern way in the specified by the W3C, but this is an old way and this also works, is to create an event. You need to say what kind of event, just a general event, and then to basically dispatch it with this init. And here you name the event, which is hello. And this will basically trigger that one and the one in JavaScript. Well, it's quite fancy. So everyone with me until this point? Let's just see the demo. But if there are questions, then feel free to ask. So I will say... anyway, the first one. So I will just execute that one demo here. Let's just run it. See the output. Plus. So. All right, that's just the name of the particular snippet that we are looking at. Then we have some output in the console already. One is before setting the handler, the other one is after setting the handler. We remember those two things are written in our JavaScript source. So they have already been executed while the document is loaded, because then I get the document loaded, which was written here. At this point, this document is ready in C sharp. And then I created this custom event and triggered that. And so I here get two lines. The first one is from the event listener I added in JavaScript, document loaded. And the other one is from the event listener I added in C sharp. Hello world from C sharp. And so everything got covered. What is this going wrong? Yeah, I see nodding faces, so I assume this is all right. So what JavaScript actually does here is magic. But what I can tell you is the following. This with JavaScript uses this JavaScript library of EngelSharp, which is called EngelSharp Scripting JavaScript, and basically provides a JavaScript engine. So when the parser sees something like the script tag, it will basically hand over the script tag to this JavaScript engine, which will then evaluate it. And since the whole document object model is known to this engine, the whole API is exposed in JavaScript, as it would be in the browser. Therefore, the whole behavior is as in the browser. However, I still got the C-sharp interaction because I'm doing everything from C-sharp. And this is quite nicely because you can see how I'm mixing things up here and that it's really providing me with this rich behavior. So just to give you the overlook of what just happened, I provided with some direct source, not some URL, and that basically was then transformed to a stream. And that stream was handed over to some preprocessor, which is called text source in form of EngelSharp. And this text source can then be queried and interacted with by some tokenizer. The tokenizer basically just requests more characters, and this is the job of the preprocessor to get those characters. Basically, what happens is the preprocessor checks, are there enough characters? If not, it will asynchronously load more characters and so on and so forth. So this is all happening quite nicely, and the whole process is asynchronously. in the end, the tree constructor is the main part. It takes those tokens, which can be HTML tags or comments or text nodes, and basically puts them together to this document object model. And this is where the interaction starts. However, some interaction points may occur before. For instance, that script tag that was already executed before, because the tree constructor already passed on the whole text source of this one script to the script engine, and that was run at that point. And as in the real browser, this is the point where the tree constructor needs to stop, because there's a really old and ugly API called document.write, which allows you to write directly on the text source. This is really bad. This is really bad for performance, and this is the reason why you should never in HTML put your scripts in the head. Actually, you should nowadays, but just one script, which is your loader for required.js. But yeah, if in doubt, just place it at the end of your body tag and you're fine. All right. And we have that huge interaction. We also got some general events in Engelshub. And general events are really nice because general events allow us to, see if something happens inside Engelshub. For instance, if a request has been triggered or if a request has been stopped or if an error occurred. And an error is not an exception now. Exceptions will bubble or be handled. But an error is an error on the page. Just to illustrate that one point, I open that sample app again. And I go to my site, because I can always bash my site without running into problems. And here's this error bar. And my site has a lot of errors, but I can live with that. For instance, and there's an error really thrown, the given tag cannot be self-closed. And this is always the same error, however, on different positions, as you can see here. Or you cannot see. Because I really like to close my image tags with a trailing slash. However, according to HTML5, this trailing slash is not needed. Image is always self-closing, and actually writing it is an error. So yeah, I live with that. I could always remove it, but this is my style. And in CSS, I also got some errors, and mostly name of declaration is unknown, but this is also fine, because here I'm just using the vendor-specific prefixes in CSS, like dash webkit dash something, for some special rules, so to cover many browsers. And I can live with that. Engelshub just tells me that all those declarations are unknown, and this is fine. But I get access to that whole information, and these are just general events. They're not propagated through the DOM, but inside Engelshub. And what is used in Engelshub is an event aggregator pattern for that. So I just subscribe with a special kind of event that I want to receive, and then I receive all notifications about that event. Cool. We've just seen scripting. I could also come up with an easier example. Now we already made a harder one, but I think the general idea is clear. I can provide whatever script engine I want to. I can also write like a C# script engine that just maps to a delegate, and basically the code is not parsed or anything, but when it is hit, it will trigger some code. And actually, I do that in some testing. But there are many scenarios, and you can also think about connecting really and really writing C# code inside a script tag. All you need to do is provide a script engine, and that's basically all there is. And Engelshub will basically call that script engine with everything that is in the script. And this gives us the abilities, many abilities, like iScriptEngine. We could also provide our own engines for whatever, parsing CSS or parsing special kinds of MIME types. So for instance, Engelshub does not know anything about images, but it knows that there is such a thing as images. And therefore, Engelshub does not know what the natural width or height or so is of an image, but it knows that it can talk to a service which maybe knows what the natural width and height and so on of that particular image is. Therefore, the image tag requests if there is a service, and if I provided a service, Engelshub will give you the information about images loaded in your document. Otherwise, it won't load any images. All right, now the real fun demo starts, and I just have one big demo, and I think all the rest will be then covered by questions, which is submitting forms. This is, I think, a nice one. What I did is I set up a simple MVC application in ASP.NET, which looks like that. The design doesn't really matter, but I thought, well, let's do something for the eye and use the standard template. And actually, there is some secret on this page, and I know exactly that I can reach it here. However, it will just bring me back to the login because, yeah, it's a secret. I need to be logged in to find it. All right, so I can log in here, and user, and this password field is a usual text box on purpose, so it's not really a secret. However, I just tell you that my password is secret. If it is something else, then I will just be redirected here. There's not even an error message, so I spared on that. But if it is the right password, then I log in. And I can also log out now. But most importantly, I can access the secret, which is that the answer to everything is 42. All right. I mean, this is basically how this web page looks like. So we need to log in order to find some particular information. And now we could use EngelSharp to do the same. First, I will show you the app, and then I will walk through the code. It's not much code. So the application started. And what we get is an address bar on the top. Yeah, whatever. I think this is read-only, but we could also make it that we can enter it. This is just for information on what page we currently are. This is will be important later. And then basically the code of this page. So I don't render anything here, but we're also not interested in rendering it. I just want to show that we could do it automatically. So no mouse needed. All right. And what this content has is... It has this login link. And this login link has a class on it, login. All right. I just made that class here to have a much easier query selector to specify for finding that link element. Because what I did in this application is I provide here a query box where I would now say login. And then I just say navigate. Now the button is really big, but I will just make it smaller. And that one will basically do a few things. First of all, it will look for an anchor element that also has this particular class. So if the selector matches, this is the right anchor element. And the next thing it will actually navigate to the target specified by this anchor element. So in this scenario, it's home login. So we will come to the login page. And then, of course, the request is triggered and so on. This happens by EngelSharp. So I just navigate, and the page changed. And miraculously, also the URL changed. I didn't do it on purpose here, so that changed from EngelSharp, actually. All right, now I got my form. Awesome. And I got two particular fields. One is called user and another one is called password. And I prepared something. And in code, you will see it. This is much easier than it looks in a UI form, but this is just for handling everything. That I can now pass in user and seek. I spare the last T just to come to the same page again. And I see the page has changed. Obviously, a request happened and we ended up in the same page, just with the values filled in. This is the same behavior as we've seen in the browser. All right, so let's provide our real password secret here. Submitted. And awesome, we are back to the home page as we've been before in the browser. But now I can also access my secret. And this one has the class secret link. So awesome. I can have a query selector for that. Of course, I could always say a nth child, whatever, but then I need to count, and I don't want to do that in that scenario. All right, let's navigate to our secret. Bam, here we are. And what we see is that the answer to everything is 42. This is our secret. This is quite nice. Now I can also navigate back. My query is just the first anchor tag, which will basically just give me the home page. So navigate, I'm back, and I can log out now using this log out. Now I'm back on the login. Let's go back to the home page again. And I see the secret link is gone. Everything's fine, exactly like in the browser. So how did I do it? It's really no magic. I created a view model. Well, this is like everything you need to know, but there are a few more things. So my view model takes care of some content, some address, some username, password, selector, and if it's loading, then buttons get enabled and disabled, whatever. And I have that website accessor that we will look at in a minute, but right now let's see what happens. If the main view model is constructed, we just set some commands. We set loading initially to true, and then we create something asynchronously, and since I can't use an async in a constructor, I will just use a continue with from the current synchronization context because I will do an UI update afterwards. And basically, what I'm doing here is just ensure that the site is loading in the beginning, disabling all the buttons, waiting until the site is initially loaded, and then displaying the result. And this displaying the result will happen in this update, which uses content and address from this accessor class that we will look at shortly. And it will also set that the loading is currently false. All right. So now those commands are interesting. First one, we have execute navigate. It won't do much. It will set the loading to true. So we're loading something now. And that we should navigate to a link given by this selector. So everything that's really interesting is really happening in this website accessor class, but we will see that in a second. And then execute submit. Here, we are creating a dictionary using user and password. Those are the fields that's named by the site. And providing the username and the password. So this website accessor is quite generic. We will see that. So it's not tailored to that specific site. However, this view model is tailored to our specific demo. So here we know exactly this user and password, but this would submit any form, actually, with the given dictionary. All right, so let's have a look at this website accessor, because obviously this is all that is interesting, and the other things are pretty standard model view model techniques. This is basically just a wrap around the browsing context, and this one we won't have a look at, because this is provided by Angularsharp. What we do is we have this create method, and it will try to create the valid URL. This URL is also an auxiliary class provided by Angularsharp, which follows the RFC specification for URLs, and is much better than URI, for instance. And it will take the string and try to create one from it. It will always be able to create one. The question is if it's is a valid URL or some invalid parts have been detected and thrown away. If this is the case, we will throw an exception, just in case. All right. Now, I get a default configuration. This is the same as saying new configuration. However, it is a little bit more flexible because I can set a general default configuration, so I have always the default basis. And this configuration object I get is immutable, so everything I do here will give me a new configuration with default loader, with, and I enter a shared cookie service, which is something I've written here and is really something primitive. Angularsharp comes also with some more sophisticated cookie service, but this one does the job for our scenario, and it is really transparent what happens here. I will show that in a second. All right, then we create this new context. We open the given URL, And once that's done, we know that the site is loaded and we can return this website accessor wrapper with the context. I mean, we could also do it differently and just return or make the constructor publicly available, just create the context and wait for a site to be entered there. But I wanted to have a different kind of pattern here where I need to provide an initial site, like an initial site for a tab or whatever, if you want to think of it like that. All right, then we've seen two properties like current source and current URL. This is just using properties of the browsing context. The browsing context has a property called active, which gives me the currently active document. So this browsing context that you can think of like a tab in your browser has also a history, and you're currently at some point in this history, most probably on top of the stack, but it could also be somewhere in the middle or on the bottom. And active will always give you the current active one. So it's nice. And two HTML will just serialize it. This is the current source I'm dealing with. And then I also have current URL. This also uses a property of the currently active document called URL, which is just where did the document come from. But there's no magic. And there's a redirect happening, for instance, in this login method. And I ended up in the home URL, and that was also displayed. So redirects and everything was handled, and I get the correct URL in the end. So that's all fine. Nice. Now I have the two methods. Navigate to link. There's not much magic happening here. I'm getting the current document. I'm placing a query selector with that selector. The only thing that's a little bit magical is that one here. And I need it because if I don't specify it, then it's basically just a generic element, an I element, and that I element doesn't have a navigate method. It's as easy as that. That's why there is a special kind of query selector that's not exposed to JavaScript and just related to C#, where we do not have those dynamic capabilities, I mean, without the DLR. And I'm just saying, just return the result if it is of type IHTML anchor. So basically, you can think of it as sparing the off-type link expression here. But everything in EngelSharp is also completely link compatible. So in a query selector, you're just getting one element, but you also have the query selector all. And this will always give you an enumerable. And you could always say something like off type and then use it here, and maybe it's first of or default, something like that. That also is possible, but right now this is a much better choice because it will stop the whole tree traversal exactly when it found the first one, and it will also just look already for some element like this, an IHTML anchor element. So it will save some performance by using this call. Anyway, this is now complicated. I don't know if you all attended the talk about C# 6. So I'm using a lot of C# 6 features here, like this Elvis operator, which is invoked if the link is non-null, because I could also have some selector that won't match anything in this document. So I will get null returned. And so link.navigate will fail. However, this one won't fail because I say just call that navigate if link is non-null, then await would fail, which is why I insert the null coalescing operator, and here just return a dummy task to make that more or less convenient. I could also just if branch. Maybe that's better, but I thought let's just use some of these features and let the compiler optimize the shit out of that. All right. And then the submit form. So this is not really hard. The navigate is already exposed by EngelSharp as an extension method, because basically all it does is looking at that anchor, trying to see if an href attribute has been set, getting the URL, and then navigating. That's all. But EngelSharp provides me some nice helpers. All right, the form submission, it works quite easily. I just need to pick a valid form, just one of this forms collection, for instance. I could also have a query selector just as above, but why not just use that forms collection? First or default, there might also be none in there. So I need to cover that. Again, the same pattern. And in the end, I end up with elements that are basically input elements in this form. And I need to fill them. And here I decided to make it quite generic. So what I'm doing is I'm looping over all those input elements. And if the given name can be found in the provided dictionary, then I'm basically fine. And I want to set the value of that element with the value that can be found at the position dictionary. So if I have, I provide in my dictionary something like a name user, password user, then this name needs to be found and it will be set with user, and also password needs to be found and will be set with secret, for instance, in this scenario. All right, finally, when I set all my values, I just call form submit, and that will basically just call the submission process as specified by the W3C with all the different handlings for post, get, whatever, and also different protocols. Nice, and this is everything that needs to be said here. Just one more thing that I promised is this shared cookie service. This is really simple because it just has one cookie. It does not differentiate between different origins. The whole API of a cookie service is to place something with an origin in there. This is the whole cookie header, and it can either be set or get. It's everything there is. And I just have that one cookie. So I do not distinguish. I just say, well, let's get that one cookie no matter what origin you are, and let's set that one cookie no matter what origin you are. I mean, this is a very special application. And this is very non-generic in this scenario. And I can see that something will happen here. Maybe not in the beginning. Let's run the application again. And after this has been built, I can log in, go to a login screen, and place my combination here, and let's just see. I submit it. First, the old cookie needs to be returned because we need to send it with our form. Okay, that's empty. Then we get the response, and we see this is our authentication cookie, and then we're done. And here we logged in into our site. All right, you can also use AngularShop for various other scenarios. One would have been front-end testing, but there's not enough time. So what the basic idea is, you do not test for if every character is what you expect, but if certain elements appear. For instance, I know that when I have in my view generation a for loop and I provide it with some sample data, and I know that's 10 of those sample items in there, the particular selector should maybe match 10 elements. If it doesn't, I've made a mistake or some other programmer changed something on the page. So I can use it in conjunction with those query selectors just to see if in certain scenarios I get the amount of expected elements. So this is what I mean with front-end testing. So basically a few testing and just seeing if the generation works as you desired. So as a summary, I would say AngularShop is quite universal. It's completely standard-driven. It's flexible. It's also fast. And most importantly, it's quite a lot of fun to automate processes. And you can use it for a lot of scenarios to really get data out of websites that otherwise lock their data and just want you to really log in into a browser. So the most interesting man also says, I don't need to parse HTML very often, but when I do, I use AngularShop. And with that, I'm open for questions, and thank you for your attention.